This is All Things Considered on North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. I'm Jeff Tiberi. With the weekend about to begin, we turn our attention to reviewing the week in state politics. Rob Schofield from the Progressive NC Policy Watch is here. So too is Becky Gray with the conservative John Locke Foundation at our legislative studio. Nice to see you both.
Nice to be
here.
Hi,
guys.
Thank you.
Still no budget or meaningful conversations between Republican leaders and the Democratic governor. And the seedlings of compromise have yet to take shape, and we'll have to wait at least another week. From inside the political bubble, there doesn't appear to be any real urgency to broker a deal on this budget impasse. So two-part question to get us going. Do you sense any determination around here, yes or no? And is there anyone alive and in the world of North Carolina politics who could possibly help to mediate the standstill?
Yeah, maybe there could be, I guess the United Nations isn't viewed very favorably by conservatives anymore. I would suggest the General Secretary, perhaps, to try to broker a compromise. Yeah, it's a tough time right now in North Carolina politics. Both sides are very set. Governor Cooper continues to try to offer olive branches to say, let's negotiate. What's your offer? I'm willing to sit down. And it seems very much that the President Pro Tem and the Speaker have stuck to their approach, that they're going to just try to override him. They are continuing to try to lure disaffected Democrats, trying to offer them pork for their votes, other concessions maybe that will be perceived as somehow favorable in their district. Governor Cooper fighting back very strongly against that. Doesn't seem to be a lot of headway, and it doesn't seem to be a lot of urgency to solve it just yet, but I think perhaps that will grow in the weeks ahead.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, as far as some kind of mediator, you know, actually, they should just send it down to us, don't you think? We're in the basement of the legislative building. We could probably have this, order in a pitcher of beer. We could probably have this thing settled within half an hour or so.
Between you two on Medicaid expansion? That's some Friday optimism.
Well, but we've got you as the mediator. Yeah. Jeff, so there you go. There you go. No, I don't really see this. I mean, we really are at a standstill. The governor keeps saying he's offered a deal, but his deal is take Medicaid expansion or nothing. I mean, that's his deal. The General Assembly sees that as not a deal. While the General Assembly is trying to get the votes to override his veto, he's out going to churches, meeting with different groups, I mean, doing everything he can, also putting a lot of pressure on those members that would potentially, we're hearing at least, would be amenable to some sort of discussion of a veto override with, you know, we're hearing threats. And so there's a lot of kind of bullying, if you will, on both sides of this. In the meantime, we have that provision that was put into law in, I think, 2016, that if we're in a situation like this, and if we are almost 3 weeks into the new budget cycle, and we don't have a budget in place, we just revert to last year's spending. So that alleviates some of the pressure. Now, I don't know whether that's good or not. I mean, maybe not having kind of that strong deadline, state government's going to quit operating. I mean, we're not in that situation. We're really okay to ride this out for a little while longer. Actually, we could ride it out for a whole year and then start over again with the short session and see where we go with that.
Senator Phil Berger sat in here in this room with me yesterday. Actually, we had an extended conversation. A lot of it was about Medicaid expansion. He has pointed to Medicaid transformation. So we're going to take a step away from expansion and talk about the 2 million people or so who are already covered via Medicaid in the state. But for them, there is a transformation process that is underway. And both he as well as Mandy Cohen, who's she's a Democratic appointee, the head of the Health and Human Services, has talked about if a deal is not reached here in roughly a month or so, it's really going to have an adverse effect on the transformation of Medicaid for those who are already covered. So I do think that's one kind of looming considerable issue.
Absolutely.
If they don't reach a deal here. This might be a throwaway, but I did want to ask you both this, and way down the road, potentially. Would you support putting Medicaid on the ballot as a referendum question for the voters?
Well, you know, in general, I don't think that's a great way to do government business. I don't think that's the system we have in North Carolina. I can think of a lot of issues that the public very strongly supports and that would pass. The minimum wage, probably. You could go down a long list of issues that the public would support.
Gun control. And Medicaid would be one, just to be clear.
I think the public
polling on Medicaid is, it's like 75%.
It depends on how you ask the question.
It does, and there was a question on a Civitas poll recently that it was a lousy
question.
Again,
depends on the way the question is asked.
Bottom line is, I think it's clear that, I mean, it's passed in deeply conservative Republican states. Out west, they've passed Medicaid expansion. I think the public's made clear they want this. I think it's going to happen eventually. We saw a 25-6 vote in a House committee last week in which Republicans and Democrats joined together to vote for a version of Medicaid expansion. I think there's clearly a majority in both houses, I said this last week, that would vote for it if they had an opportunity to do that. It's just the leadership doesn't want to. Phil Berger has been running the state for 10 years, and he doesn't want to give in.
Well, Jeff, in answer to your question, should we have a statewide referendum? And we're not a referendum state. And I think the reason for that is the founders of North Carolina state government put a tremendous amount of power and authority within our legislature. And the reason why we don't have referendums is because we defer or authorize our legislature to make those decisions. And this is a case where that needs to be done. I would strongly oppose something like that because I think it lets the legislators off the hook. And I think a lot of the decisions are tough decisions to make, but that's why they're elected. That's why they're elected, to represent their constituents. And to kind of bring this Medicaid expansion question back to that, it seems to me that legislators really ought to be talking to their constituents about not just whether they want a very expensive Medicaid expansion program that will cost $6 billion in the first 2 years, or if they want a state budget that puts in place many of the very good things, $24 billion worth of spending that's in that state budget that has come to a halt under all of this.
I was going to move on, and then you said $6 billion.
I hate for us just to keep going over the same ground. Obviously, the vast majority of that money is going to come from the federal government. Becky's going to say, well, where does that money come from? And I'm going to tell you that money's going to other states right now is where that money is going. It would create thousands of jobs in North Carolina. It would be a big injection into our economy. We have a debate there. But the bottom line is that I think the public wants it. I think it's inevitable. I think it's going to happen. It's just a matter of time.
On Thursday, the worst-kept secret in Raleigh reached audiences statewide when Republican Representative Holly Grange of New Hanover County formally announced that she will challenge Dan Forrest in the gubernatorial primary. Grange is a West Point graduate in her third term here at the General Assembly. Forrest has been lieutenant governor for 6 years and I think still is seen as the front-runner in this primary. We're likely to see some infighting within the party. Becky, I'm wondering, what is Holly Grange's path to victory?
That's a good question. I mean, making her case to the Republican primary voters is her path to victory. And then if she gets through that primary, making that case to the voters across North Carolina. And again, we've just gotten this announcement, beginning to see her message kind of be formulated. She has a very strong military background. She is a guns rights advocate. That was in this video that was released, talking about creating jobs in North Carolina. I mean, I'm just trying to think, initially, what is she putting?
Let me ask
there.
You a quick follow-up, because she released this 2-minute video on Thursday kicking off the campaign. To some of us who are observers of the North Carolina legislature, didn't seem to be totally in step with who we've seen as a legislator. Almost seemed to signal, all right, she's moving to the right, the Trump support, the Second Amendment stuff. That was my read, for one. How did you view it?
Maybe a little bit. Of course, Representative Grange has been in the General Assembly for 3 terms. She has moved pretty quickly to leadership positions. But, you're right. She hasn't had that sort of name-claiming issues that she has been behind, like we see with some of the lawmakers. So there's a disadvantage to that. But on the other hand, there's an advantage to it in that she can define herself now as she moves into this gubernatorial race. And the jobs are very different, an executive job as opposed to a legislative job. What she's focusing on is her leadership capabilities, her military background, job creation, and, her conservative credentials going into this primary.
Path to victory here?
Well, I assume it's going to have to include going after Lieutenant Governor Forrest. She's going to have to make the connection to the corruption with the Lindbergh case that has been, one of the biggest stories in North Carolina politics this year. I can't see a way that she gets traction in the Republican primary unless she does something Forrest clearly has name recognition advantage. He's been doing it for a long time. He's got a lot of money. Mm-hmm. She's going to have to go after him and connect him to that, which is a pretty doable thing, one would think. I mean, their politics seemed to be, I think you're right, she didn't really necessarily have a reputation as a true fire-breathing right-winger in the General Assembly, but the video is pretty far out there. It is Trumpism in all of its glory. I mean, she's accusing abortion rights supporters of being guilty of cold-blooded murder. She's talked about being locked and loaded with the NRA and teaching people how to use guns. I assume Forrest will, I mean, she has some limited connections to North Carolina, right? She's not a native, as I recall. Am I right?
I do not believe
I think she's a
native.
Transplant, is my recollection.
Well, you know, but you still can run for governor, even
I'm not. I'm just saying, I'm trying to think of the things that, you know, what does Forrest say in
What's
response?
The separation?
You
sure.
know,
Pat McCrory
could imagine
is from Ohio and Phil right. Berger's from Virginia, but I point.
You could imagine something like, I'm just trying to think. I mean, there's clearly this other issue that Becky's alluded to in the past of this divide. The Republican Party's had not a lot of success with women candidates. We just saw that in the 3rd Congressional mm-hmm. District, and this is another effort by a very conservative woman to change that. It'll be very interesting to see whether there are enough women Republican voters who are willing to embrace that and give her a close look.
Well, and along those lines, you know, national attention I think there's going to be a tremendous amount of national attention in North Carolina's gubernatorial race. Now, how much of that is going to be in the Republican mm-hmm. primary, I'm not sure. But what we saw in the 3rd District race was a lot of, really surprised me, to be honest with you, the national attention from women's groups, conservative women's groups, who came in and helped Joan Perry in that.
Right, she's still lost by 20
points. Yeah, but a newcomer, somebody that, you know, really didn't have a election campaign machine in place, but still generated a lot of interest at the national level and a lot of money at the national level. So, you know, this whole, and I think we're seeing this on the Democrat side, is that there's a lot of support for female candidates and women to get more engaged and more involved. And I think that's both parties.
And women on the left thus far, or in recent cycles, have had more election cycles, have had more success. I guess a couple of quick points. There are concerns from some of the Republicans I talked to about Dan Forrest's electability in a general election. We should note, and I do agree with you, I think we're going to see a lot of money coming into the gubernatorial race. I think most listeners remember razor-thin margin, right? Cooper ousted McCrory. It was less than 11,000 votes. One other thing, maybe just worth going in the trash, but Wednesday night, Donald Trump was on campus at East Carolina, mentioned Forrest by name. Grange was not in the building, for whatever that's worth.
Had not announced yet.
Yeah, but there were a number of state lawmakers mm-hmm. who were in the building that night. She wasn't one of them.
And on her campaign video, she has lots of pictures of her standing next to Trump. So I'm sure they will both be seeking the Trump mantle.
But no matter what, mm-hmm. I think that Holly Grange and those of us who know her, who have watched her here at the General Assembly and kind of watched her leadership growth, no matter where this gubernatorial race goes, I think she's somebody to really keep an eye on and watch. And if she's not successful in this, I would be very surprised if we didn't see her in other roles, whether that's a congressional race, a Senate race. I mean, you know, we got other things mm-hmm. on down the line. Mm-hmm. So I think Holly Grange is absolutely a leader and someone to pay attention to.
Clearly ambitious. When you go right from being only in the House for a few years and announced for governor, you've got some high ambitions.
A partisan gerrymandering challenge is taking place in state court. Quick background, nonprofit Common Cause says that Republican legislators have violated 3 provisions in the state constitution in the last process of establishing political maps for state House and state Senate districts. This trial is expected to extend another week, and then, regardless of the verdict by the 3-judge panel, will be appealed up to the state Supreme Court. Your biggest takeaway so far from these first few days of testimony, Becky?
First of all, that Bob Phillips, who is with Common Cause, he is Common Cause, the plaintiff in this case, admitted after some questioning that the reason why they had filed that lawsuit is because they had been unsuccessful in getting a law passed through the General Assembly. I thought that was pretty telling. I mean, you know, I'm just hoping that, you know, the 100-plus lobbyists that are in this building trying to get their laws passed in these last days of the General Assembly don't all of a sudden start thinking, well, I'll just take it to court to get those things passed. I found that also just, you know, the defendants in this really sticking to their story that they have not broken any laws in this. I mean, the two sides seem to be consistent in the evidence and the discussion mm-hmm. along the questioning. I mean, and so I guess one of the takeaways is there really haven't been any surprises in this.
I find it a little surprising. I mean, David Lewis, Representative David Lewis, who's been a big defendant in all this, has made a lot of statements over the last few months and years. But I thought his press conference this week, in which he just used terrible language assailing Bob Phillips in a way that was just, I just thought was beyond the pale. Bob is one of the most honorable, ethical people. He has been fighting for redistricting reform. He fought the Democrats over it. He has devoted his life to this cause. He once worked with David Lewis. David Lewis once sponsored legislation with, worked with Bob Phillips to pass nonpartisan redistricting reform. And then for Lewis to come out there and accuse Phillips of being some sort of pawn of the Democrats was just,
inconsistent with who he's been. Inconsistent with who Phillips
clearly,
has been.
Clearly. I just thought it was shot. I thought, I don't even think Lewis really believes what he's saying. It was like he was reading a speech written by some fire-breathing intern or something like that. It was very disappointing. The bottom line is that, as Phillips has made very clear and Common Cause has made clear, we need to do away with partisan partisan gerrymandering in North Carolina. The legislature has the power to do that tomorrow. They could pass a law to do this. They could pass a genuine redistricting reform that gets rid of partisan gerrymandering, that makes for an open process, transparent process for drawing maps, and the lawsuit would go away. And there's nothing wrong with advocacy groups. It happens all the time when groups file lawsuits based upon the Constitution because lawmakers are not doing their constitutional duty, and that's what's going on here. There's nothing wrong. In fact, it's encouraging that Phillips has brought this lawsuit and Common Cause has done so. I think they should have done so years ago.
Well, of course, the question here is, did the General Assembly violate those three constitutional claims as
right.
Common Cause is making? One of the things, after this is all settled and depending on what the courts decide, and right now it appears to me that the judgment would be that they did not break the law, that they did comply with the Constitution. But what that does
that's
is
your
it that's
position.
My personal
okay. All right.
opinion.
Just making
yeah,
sure
absolutely.
I understand.
And I am not a lawyer. I am just a casual, observer of all of this. But to make my point, where that would leave us and something that we might could think about after when this is over is, do we need to change our Constitution to put things in there that might eliminate some of the questions and the problems
sure.
that have been and concerns that have been brought forward? And so one of the things, and of course the General Assembly can do that, they can vote to put a constitutional amendment on the ballot. So depending on what this case looks like, one of the solutions, as Rob's talked about, and we have agreed on this for over the years, nonpartisan or not even necessarily nonpartisan, but a fairer way to draw the districts. And one of those ways may be to just encapsulate and ensure the rules in the state constitution so that whoever is drawing that map has a strict set of rules that they comply with.
Before I move on, were you disappointed in Lewis's rhetoric?
I was not surprised by Lewis's rhetoric. This is when you bring a case based on this, and David Lewis's reputation and his what he has done through this redistricting has been attacked for years.
That is correct.
Well, he's done a flip-flop of monumental proportions.
Well, but there's
That's
and
surprising.
Emotions run high, and personality things. I was not surprised by it. To be honest with you, I don't know whether the argument that, and I know Bob Phillips, and I do think he's a nice guy. I don't know whether the argument is whether Bob Phillips is a nicer guy than David Lewis. I'm not sure that, it's something
no
that we can talk about.
Is.
But the question is, what is in our Constitution? Did the General Assembly violate any of those provisions?
I think that's right. And I think we're going to find out they did.
I want to end with a curveball. A question that is largely away from politics.
Uh-oh.
50 years ago tomorrow, Saturday, Apollo 11 landed on the moon. 6 hours later, Neil Armstrong became the first person to walk on the moon. What do you remember, if you recall anything at all, about that moment now half a century ago?
I've watched so many retrospectives over here in the last few weeks that it's, sometimes it conflates what you actually remember and what you've watched in the last few years. But I do remember sitting in front of a very old-fashioned television in the 1960s as a young boy watching very grainy, sort of confusing photos, but being very aware of what a monumental effort was. My father worked in the space program in aerospace, and it was a thing that as I grew up, and I think a lot of Americans grew up, we felt a personal, it's just hard to imagine today in our divided country. There was almost a, a national esprit de corps, a feeling that we were all in this, that President Kennedy had promised we were going to do this before the end of the decade, and by God, we were going to do it. And I felt a personal connection to Walter Cronkite's description of it on television when I was a 9-year-old. And I wish we could find some things like that today, whether it's climate change, where it's something, an existential threat to our society, that we could come together like we did during that era. That was a very heady time.
I remember my mother talking about it more than anything, and talking about it on that day, but also talking about it in months and really years after that. And mm-hmm. the comment that she made was that it was so amazing to her and to people of her generation to see a man walk on the moon, that she was so awestruck by all of that. But she looked at my brother and I and she said, you know, in your lifetime, that will become commonplace. And what is so awe-inspiring and so just unbelievable to her and her generation would be, again, more commonplace for my brother and I. And I think that, you know, her words played out. And you look at where we are. I mean, you know, imagine with that, you know, if Neil Armstrong had a cell phone, or if he'd, right. you know, if he'd had a laptop, you know, I mean, imagine, you know, all of that and just the things that we can do on the internet. And so that, it was a defining moment in so many ways, but that's what I remember about it.
Becky Gray is Senior Vice President at the John Locke Foundation. Rob Schofield is Director of NC Policy Watch. Enjoy that warm weekend.
Stay cool, guys.
Thank you.